Go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Visit msnbc.com/app to download.
Good morning and welcome to Morning Joe. It is Friday, May 27th. This morning, a new account from police about the response to the school massacre in Uvalde, Texas, is leading to new questions about why it took 1 hour for police to take down the killer and why the doors of the school were unlocked. We also are hearing more stories from survivors and their parents, including a girl who smeared blood on herself and played dead to avoid getting shot, a fourth grader. Also hearing from parents who say they rushed into the school themselves to save their children, not waiting for police. And the tragedy compounded for one family, unbearably. The husband of one of the two teachers killed in the shooting dies from a heart attack just days after the shooting in the school. With us this morning, we have the host of Way Too Early and White House Bureau Chief at Politico, Jonathan Lemire, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC News, Caddy Kay, and MSNBC contributor Mike Barnicle. We begin this morning with those questions about the police response to the shooting in Uvalde. Some of the key details provided by Texas officials in the first 48 hours after the attack have turned out to be inaccurate. Here is what has changed. Texas officials first said the attacker exchanged gunfire with a school resource officer before entering the school. Then later said the school resource officer engaged with the attacker but did not exchange gunfire. Well, yesterday, officials now said, in fact, there was no school resource officer there at all, and that the killer walked into the school through an unlocked door, unobstructed, and began firing. The amount of time the gunman spent outside before entering the school also has changed. We initially were told after he shot his grandmother, he fled, crashed a truck outside of the school, and then ran inside. Yesterday, officials said after crashing the truck, he got out, fired toward two witnesses who were at a funeral home across the street, then walked toward the school, climbed a fence to enter the parking lot of the school, and then began firing at the school building from the outside. Officials say 12 minutes passed from the time he crashed to when he entered the school. He was outside that school for 12 minutes. Also now a discrepancy about where the victims were found. It initially was reported that the gunman spent an entire hour inside a single classroom and that all of the victims killed were inside that one classroom. NBC News now has learned from Texas officials the victims were found in four classrooms. Here's the new timeline from Texas officials about what happened right after the gunman entered the school and began shooting.
4 minutes later, local police departments, Uvalde Police Department, the Independent School District Police Department are inside, making entry. They hear gunfire, they take rounds, they move back, get cover. And during that time, they approach where the suspect is at. Officers are there, the initial officers, they receive gunfire. They don't make entry initially because of the gunfire they're receiving. But we have officers calling for additional resources. Everybody that's in the area, tactical teams. We need equipment. We need specialty equipment. We need body armor. We need precision riflemen, negotiators. So during that time that they're making those calls to bring in help, to solve this problem and stop it immediately, they're also evacuating personnel, not say personnel, students, teachers.
The Texas Department of Public Safety then said an hour passed before a tactical team arrived and shot and killed the suspect. Yesterday, NBC's Kerry Sanders asked what else police were doing in that hour to save lives.
You say at one point when he was inside there, among the things you were attempting negotiation, was he responding to negotiation? And in that period of time, was there continued gunfire?
So during that time, right now, according to the information we have, the majority of the gunfire was in the beginning. In the beginning. I say numerous, more than 25. I mean, it was a lot of gunfire in the beginning. During the negotiations, there wasn't much gunfire other than trying to keep the officers at bay but that could change depending as once we analyze the video. But right now, according to the information, he did not respond.
Joining us now from Uvalde, Texas, is NBC News correspondent Sam Brock. Sam, it's really breathtaking. It's like we're talking about two different incidents, from the first reports from police about what happened at Robb Elementary School to what we heard yesterday in a press conference that, by the way, actually raised more questions to be answered today.
Willie, good morning. Look, I think it is worth noting the fact that this investigation is still being conducted. We're learning new pieces of information about what happened when in this tragic sequence on Tuesday. That said, what we have heard from local law enforcement officials here is not only confusing, but utterly conflicting. To your point there about this being breathtaking, just all sorts of information that does not align, starting, Willie, with what happened when the shooter arrived on campus. We know this, that at 11:28, he crashed his grandmother's truck after he shot his grandmother, pulled out of the car with a long rifle and fired bullets at nearby witnesses at a funeral home. Then some 12 minutes later, actually did enter the school. But this is where it becomes extremely confusing. We heard just a second ago from the regional director there that there was no school resource officer to confront him. However, 24 hours prior, the director of DPS offered an account of that exchange where he says there was a courageous confrontation with a school resource officer. 24 hours later, that person no longer exists. That's question number one. Also, how did he actually get into the building? They say it appears that a door on the side of the building was unlocked. And now look, Willie, you can double your security budget, which in Uvalde County here, they have done just that. They've doubled security at this school district. And yet if a door is left open, kids' lives will be compromised. It appears that that was fatal consequences in this case. Now let's move over to what seems to be the most dissected aspect of all of this. At 11:44, 4 minutes after the gunman entered the school, Robb Elementary School, that's when local law enforcement arrived. According to officials, they had to retreat under fire. There was an AR-15 style assault weapon the shooter was using. They left the building and waited for an hour. And you heard the explanation there just a second ago. For precision riflemen, tactical gear, specialized equipment, and negotiators. Now, the president for the School Safety Advocacy Council, which trains Willie schools on how to respond to school shootings, said that sort of thinking is completely outdated, basically since Columbine. That now protocol is for law enforcement officers, whether it's one, three, or four, to enter the building immediately if there is an active shooter situation and try to neutralize the threat. And yet here, it took until 12:47 for CBP to arrive and, quote, neutralize the threat. And in that time frame, we've seen the video, Willie, of parents standing outside and just wondering, what is going on here? They were trying to rip down fences, break into windows to get into that school building so they could do whatever possible to try to save their kids' lives. And ultimately, 19 children between the ages of 8 and 10, fourth graders, murdered as an hour goes by. And that really is the heart of this investigation right now. And so many questions surrounding that very issue. Why do you have a Texas law enforcement agency saying the protocol was to wait for this sort of more tactical assistance and special forces to arrive to handle the situation when there were kids dying by the minute inside of that school? And where? You know, you mentioned one classroom. Originally, we were told that all of the victims were in that one location. And now it appears that there were four classrooms with kids and potentially teachers affected. Willie?
And Sam, as you say, we're looking at this video of parents. We now have firsthand accounts from parents who say they, in fact, did go into the school and get their kids. They just weren't going to wait anymore. Sam, stay with us. I want to bring into our conversation NBC News investigations correspondent Tom Winter. Tom, boy, so many fictions told on the first day. We understand that these things are complicated and sometimes that the details and the facts that first come out in this fog of war setting can be inaccurate, but there are some fundamental contradictions in the initial story that was told and to what it appears actually happened. The only one that really matters right now, and we can talk about whatever you want to get to, but did those kids die in that hour when the teams were standing outside, not going inside the building? Did it cost the lives of children?
We'll get back in a moment, Willie, to one of the sloppiest public information responses I've ever seen to any sort of mass incident like this. And I've covered this and been on this beat for approximately 10 years. Moving beyond that to your question, which is the central question, which is kids' lives. Last night in an interview, last evening with CNN. One of the colleagues of that Texas DPS individual there said that there were victims and there were kids that they were able to get out of that classroom. That's consistent with our colleague Kerry Sanders's reporting. So now you have to ask the natural question that if this shooter was killed earlier, would more children be alive today? And I think that's the bottom line. There are serious questions about this, not just coming from you, myself, from people that are watching this, but also from the policing community. Speaking of former chiefs yesterday who trained people in this that were responsible for officers that would go into these types of situations, I think they find the response to be extremely troubling. Those are the types of words that they're using with me. There is no school of thought currently in U.S. law enforcement, and this does go back to Columbine, as Sam referenced, but particularly because now we've had so many of these incidents, and so many of these incidences have been studied as far as what went right and what went wrong. And it's very clear here that the basic protocols of you get a couple officers together, so you have somebody on your right, your left, somebody behind you, and you go in. I'm not sitting here saying today that I would look forward to going after somebody who's got an AR-15, has already shot at and killed individuals, and you've got two little kids in this instance, somebody who, based on the information that we're aware of from inside this classroom, is incredibly depraved. And we're withholding some of those details just because out of sensitivity to these poor families that are going through this, Willie. I'm not saying that I would jump up and be the first in line for that, but that is their job, and that is the reality, unfortunately, that they have to deal with. They're dealing with somebody who has a high-powered weapon, a weapon that would hurt somebody like myself, 240 pounds, 6'3". One bullet could end me out of that gun, let alone little kids. So they needed to get in there. They needed to confront the threat. As somebody said to me yesterday, Willie, it is not minutes that count. It is seconds that count. That yeah. is how dangerous this situation was for those little kids. And they say that they have video of this. They've said a lot of things so far. And for us not to have a timeline at this stage of the investigation, a preliminary one, is frankly shocking.
And Tom, you talk about seconds and minutes. We know from this new official report that the gunman entered the school at 11:40 a.m. and that tactical team from Border Patrol arrived at 12:47. That's an hour and 7 minutes of his being in the school with those kids. Many of the parents in Uvalde are recounting what they saw outside of Robb Elementary during the attack. Javier Caceres, whose fourth grade daughter Jacqueline was killed by the shooter, was among the dozens of parents outside the school after finding out there was a shooting. He rushed there, of course. He told the New York Times law enforcement is misrepresenting what happened, saying, quote, they said they rushed in and all that. We didn't see that. He says he saw police officers evacuating children, but grew angry when he did not see officers enter the school immediately. Mr. Cazares went on to say, quote, there were plenty of men out there armed to the teeth that could have gone in faster. This could have been over in a couple of minutes, end quote. He also claims it took 15 or 20 minutes for law enforcement officers to bring protective shields to enter the school. Anjali Rose Gomez, whose children are in second and third grade, told the Wall Street Journal she drove 40 miles to the school after learning about the shooting. She says she saw one of a number of parents who began encouraging police and other law enforcement, first politely and then with more urgency, as you can imagine, to enter the school. Gomez told the Journal U.S. Marshals put her in handcuffs, telling her she was being arrested for intervening in an active investigation. She's a parent. She says local officers she knew convinced the marshals to set her free. Gomez says she then got some distance from the crowd, jumped a fence, went inside the school, found her two children, and ran out of the building with them. Videos shared online show distraught parents outside the school on Tuesday confronting law enforcement. Other family members have claimed they were detained and handcuffed as well. The U.S. Marshals issued a statement denying anyone was put in handcuffs outside of the school on Tuesday. Mike Barnicle, you've covered a lot of these tragedies. Unfortunately, you've watched police work up close for decades. You've watched how the stories of the incidents have been told. What did you make of what you saw yesterday?
Well, I'm in total agreement with Tom Winter's assessment. This is beyond shocking. And Sam's reporting on this is also beyond shocking. Your first instinct is to do the TikTok on the 12 minutes that we're talking about here. Those 12 minutes from the time that he emerges from the crashed car, fires a couple of shots across the street toward the funeral home, and 11 and a half minutes later, finally enters the school. So the TikTok on that, Willie, I think is going to be critical. When was the first 911 call logged? What's the time and distance between arriving officers in the area? Things like that. You're hesitant to second guess anyone being confronted by an AR-15 and a crazed gunman. But the 12 minutes time, that is so critical in terms of what eventually happened. In all probability, sadly, but realistically, once he enters the school, once he enters a classroom or classrooms, within 2 or 3 minutes, the horrific deed is done. He has killed numerous numbers of children. But the 12 minutes prior to that, prior to his entry into the school, I think is going to take care of a lot of the issues that people have, a lot of the questions that have been raised. And, you'd have to say again, and this is repetitive off of what Tom has just pointed out and what Sam has reported, the confusion and the muddling accounts given the public in a horrendous, horrendous crime like this is maddening. Actually, it's beyond maddening. You have parents who have been waiting for some information for 2-3 days now. The first information that's been dispensed, I won't say it's a lie, but it's horrifically misleading. And we have to find out exactly what happened, who did what, and where they were.
Sam Brock, this tragedy becomes even more unbearable, if you can imagine such a thing, as you watch this morning. When we learned yesterday that the husband of Irma Garcia, the fourth grade teacher who was killed in that classroom, who was found huddled over her children, trying to protect them from the bullets of an AR-15, suffered a heart attack and died. What more can you tell us about that?
Irma Garcia, Willie, taught at the school for 23 years, and she was married to her high school sweetheart, Joe, who you're looking at the left side of your screen right now. So 24 years of marriage, but 30 plus years of a lifelong love. They had 4 children together, the youngest of whom only 12 years old. And according to a family nephew, John Martinez, he died of grief, but he also relayed to us sort of the sequence he understood from family members, which was that after laying down flowers at a memorial, Joe Garcia returned home, sat down in a chair, and within minutes, Willie, fell over. They tried to have chest compressions to see if they could bring him back. It didn't work. He died. And so now behind me, you have 21 of those crosses, memorials. That's Miss Garcia's memorial right there, her cross. And you have a second family member. After everything they've been through, she gave her life trying to protect students by shielding them with her body. Now her husband, the love of her life, has also passed away. I will leave you with this, however. There is a GoFundMe account that's been set up. Their target for the family members, for those 4 kids, was $10,000. As of this morning at last check, $1.8 million has been generated, has been raised for that family to try to help them. But nothing, no amount of money or generosity across the country is going to soothe the heartache that they are experiencing right now. And that is so emblematic of what this entire community is going through at this point in time, Willie.
Yeah, and as you say, they have 4 children, including a 13-year-old who 5 days ago had their mother and father with them and now have neither because of this shooting. NBC's Sam Brock in Uvalde, Texas. We'll be back to you. Thanks so much. We're hearing more about what happened inside Robb Elementary on Tuesday from students who survived the attack. Here are some of their accounts.
I hear the shooter try to shoot at an officer. They ran past the restroom and went back inside.
What were you thinking as you were hiding in that bathroom for so long?
I think I was just trying to be still, not move, talk. I was just crying my head, just don't make no noise.
Everybody was scared.
We were all panicking because we didn't know what was really happening. All we saw were thousands of police and Border Patrol coming into the cafeteria. And we were all hiding behind a stage in the cafeteria when it happened.
I got really scared and I didn't know who was her or dead. And then we started looking around on Facebook. And then I realized that all the people I knew were dead now.
What do you mean, baby? How many?
I knew all of them.
The aunt of another young girl, Mia, who was in the classroom where the murders took place, says her niece resorted to drastic measures in order to stay alive.
Mia got some blood and put it on herself, but she couldn't pretend that she was dead. Grandma said that. She saw her friend full of blood, and she got blood and put it on herself.
Caddy, what can you say? We're talking about third and fourth graders, little girls with ribbons in their hair, smearing the blood of their classmates on their bodies and playing dead so that an 18-year-old with an AR-15 won't kill them, too.
Yeah, I mean, poor little girl, because now she's, you know, that all of those children who we've just heard from, Willie, traumatized beyond belief, that little girl is going to go home with incredibly complicated, terrified feelings. How these kids go back into a schoolroom come the fall, I just don't know. I mean, they're going to have their own grief at their friends that have lost. That little girl who said she knew all of them, her friends have gone. You know, her little group of friends have gone. And that's, they're all dealing with extraordinary levels of trauma. And of course, the families with all of those questions. And Tom, one of the things I don't know if you know it yet is how frequently do they have active shooter drills in those police communities? And when was the last one? Because I imagine this is a preparation that needs to be done regularly for it to be effective, because it doesn't sound like it was effective in this case.
Well, it's a terrific question. It's one of the questions that we're trying to get answered. And, you know, one of the things when I speak to these chiefs that have trained people on this is you have to continually train. And the reason for that is you have to continually get it into your mindset, the mindset of the officers who are going to be out there, who are going to be responding. Not talking about the SWAT officers, talking about the person who's working at that school or the person who might be in that community. Any one of those officers needs to be continually trained, because you want to ingrain in your head this idea of move to the shooter. The NYPD has that phrase. I've been out with them when they've trained in their facility where they train for these active shooters. It's constantly, you got to move to the shooter, the exact thing that you don't want to do, the thing that your fight or flight in life is somebody shooting. Why do I want to go to that? But that's the type of thing that needs to constantly be drilled into you, so you get that in your head as a police officer. These are from the people that train them, that are around this all day long, that study these mass shootings, that say that's what's going to happen. You have to continually train and get it in your head that seconds count, and you have to do the exact thing your body and brain is telling you not to do.
A potential news conference today from Texas law enforcement is only going to prompt more questions, as to try to get a sense as to what happened there and the delays in response, just infuriating. And we saw the response from those parents. Tom, I want to shift gears slightly and talk about the shooter.
Right.
Have there been any updates, any progress in the investigation into the motive behind this? Have we heard from his family at all? Is there any sense as to what connection, if any, he has to that school and why he chose to make it a target?
That is the ultimate question when it comes to his motive at this point. There's some indications they've been able to get into some of his electronic devices. We don't know the contents, what's contained inside of those devices. I mean, clearly, you would assume by now that the full web browser history of this individual, text messages, any sort of communications, he was clearly communicating with somebody on Facebook in the moments leading up to this shooting. So who else has he been communicating with over the past 6 months, 12 months? So it doesn't appear, based on the various interviews and discussions that the family members have had with members of the press, that anybody has any sort of sense as to why this school, why did this occur, and how did this all kind of come together. You know, we're talking about information here, and I know, you know, Mike, you know this well from the Boston Marathon bombing. I rewatched Ed Davis, who's the former commissioner of the Boston Police, last night, give an update on this. And, you know, Jonathan, you mentioned that we're going to going to get an update today. I think it is incredibly important for the law enforcement officials in Texas to take a moment and regroup. It's understandable in the first few hours after an incident that things can get jumbled up and mixed up. But you presumably, you had officers there with body cameras. They say that there's video, there's a surveillance video system at the school of some kind. That's what they've said, that they have video of this. Somebody's going to be assigned to, and depending on the body camera system, they have this ability. Just say, you know what, get everybody's body cameras and let's start it at 11:28. And they can view all the different views at the same time. That's the computer system. I've seen it myself. So they would have the ability of saying, okay, what happens when? What happens where? Because the timing of this is so critical. And what are the steps that this person takes? And it's time for real concrete information. I understand, and I don't think anybody is asking for a where did this shell casing land, or how many inches was he from this or that. That is going to take months of time to do, maybe even longer. But I think at this point, we need a very clear understanding of the timeline. We need a very clear understanding of what happened. You say you call for a negotiator, but then Kerry asks you the question, our colleague Kerry Sanders, there's no discussion in that time period. What's the thinking there? So I think today, I would argue days ago, but today is the day for real answers. They have to get this right. Their credibility going forward has been severely questioned at this point. And they really have this press conference to try to reestablish any of it.
And Tom, as you point out, we understand how difficult the job is. We understand the courage it takes to walk up on a shooter, but it is the job. And my question to you is, this is a school district. We're talking about hardening schools, who has poured money into school safety. It has its own police force putting physical barriers up and fencing and all the rest of the precautions and beyond the precautions that many schools even took after Sandy Hook. So my question about the school resource officer is, was there ever a school resource officer at this particular school? We know now that there wasn't the one that day, despite what we were told at the outset. Do they have school resource officers in this district?
They do in this district. It kind of has its own police force, if you will, and they doubled their budget from 2017 from $200,000 to $450,000, according to public records. They did install an alarm system, which, based on their documents, appears to be maybe for more of an after hours, make sure nobody's getting into the building when it's not occupied. But I think that's the big question. And, you know, the other question I would have is, so you know that the day of the shooting, Tuesday was an awards day where they were coming towards the end of the school year. You're going to have parents coming in and out. You're going to have people coming in and out of the school. Who's coming in and out of the school? So you're not going to have the normal, perhaps, security setup that you would have. So in light of that, how come you don't have an officer there? I mean, the very horrible reality of this is that the school shootings have come from being an aberration to something that we have to deal with every single school year. Frankly, myself and my colleagues here, we know when schools are back in session in the summertime, don't really need to be told, because we know that the active shooter calls, school shooting calls, start coming in to us and every other news organization starting mid-August. That's the sad reality of where we are now. So knowing that, that seems to me to be a key question, because why on a day where you know you're going to have a lot of people coming in and out of the school, presumably parents there for all the wonderful reasons that they should be there, that seems like a day that you want to have a little extra protection on campus.
And again, the first account from authorities was that the shooter was confronted by a school resource officer, that two other local police officers were on the scene. Now we know he was not confronted by anybody, that he walked around the school for 12 minutes before entering the school through an unlocked door, spending more than an hour inside before he was killed. NBC News Investigations correspondent Tom Winter with all the latest details on this. Tom, thanks so much. Still ahead this morning, a bipartisan group of lawmakers holds initial talks about a path forward on gun safety legislation. What are they talking about, though? And will it get done? We'll have the latest on those efforts and the push by Mitch McConnell to get one of his Republican colleagues involved in that conversation. Plus, Texas Governor Greg Abbott answers the question about whether he will attend the NRA convention in Houston that kicks off today. We'll let you know whether he'll be there or not. Also ahead, after the Parkland school shooting in 2018, former New York City Police Commissioner Bill Bratton said the answer to gun violence is not more guns. He'll be our guest this morning. You're watching Morning Joe on a Friday morning. We'll be right back.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
President Biden and First Lady Biden will travel to Uvalde, Texas on Sunday to meet with the families of the victims of the elementary school shooting there. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, a bipartisan group of senators has begun to hold talks, informal talks anyway, about new potential gun safety legislation. Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut spearheading that effort along with Senator Richard Blumenthal. They both were heavily involved in the failed efforts to pass background check legislation in the wake of the shooting at Sandy Hook in their state of Connecticut a decade ago. At the meeting yesterday, Democrats Kyrsten Sinema, Martin Heinrich, and Joe Manchin. The Republicans who joined were Senators Susan Collins, Lindsey Graham, and Pat Toomey. Senator Bill Cassidy joined by phone. We also know Minority Leader Mitch McConnell encouraged Texas Senator John Cornyn to meet with that group. McConnell said he plans to keep in touch with Democrats and hopes lawmakers can reach a deal that can, quote, actually pass and become law, rather than just scoring points back and forth. Joining us now, co-founder and CEO of Axios, Jim VandeHei. Jim, good morning. We heard from Senator Manchin yesterday. He said this time feels different. We should note that he said that after Parkland as well. We've heard that refrain from many people, especially after Sandy Hook. Is there any reason to believe that this time is different? Are there votes? Are there Republican senators willing to look, for example, at universal background checks, which is a 90-10 issue in this country?
Yeah, I mean, maybe there's a little bit of hope. I mean, we should have some perspective in terms of what they're talking about. This isn't massive sort of new gun control legislation. Right. What they're talking about is basically two pieces. One is some incentives for states to enact red flag laws, which basically allow either families or judges in many of these states to intervene when people feel like someone's a threat to themselves and a threat to others. That even there, they're not talking about a mandate for every state to do this, or the current talks are around, can we provide incentives, maybe grants to states to make sure that they have effective red flag laws. And then the background checks, which would be substantive because it would extend the background check that you would get if you went to an authorized gun dealership. It would extend it to other places, online or gun shows. And so those are the two main components. They're not getting at the weapons that are being used or the ability for most people in most states to quite easily buy these weapons. But there is some progress. And I think the fact that Mitch McConnell as John Cornyn in there is somewhat meaningful in that he is close to him. He does sort of represent a leadership. There, you know, you have Toomey, you have Manchin and others who are in close conversation with people saying it does feel different, that they do feel like they could get something done. As you know, Willie, the only way to really get something done is to move quickly. Every day that passes after a big moment, a tragic moment like this, means there's less and less of a chance of something substantive getting done. I think the most likely outcome is maybe they get a very small bill done this year, and then it becomes a big topic of the election again. I think Democrats want a big debate on this. They feel that a lot of the provisions that they support are supported by most of the country, and they're happy to have that debate, just like happy to have the debate on abortion. So most likely these will be political topics much more than sort of policy solutions.
Yeah, Jim, that needed sense of urgency you just mentioned is why so many Democrats were angry. The Senate now out on recess. They're out next week. Although, of course, that is part because that gives some senators some time to work on a deal. We'll see if that comes to be from the White House's perspective, looking at executive orders. Now, they've already issued a bunch. There's not much they can do. Maybe something on ghost guns. But that's not real. A real solution is going to come. But I want to ask you about the Republican political calculation here. As we talked about on the show yesterday, the NRA, which, of course, is having its convention this weekend in Houston, not even 300 miles from the massacre scene, is a bit of a diminished political figure. It does not quite have the influence and certainly doesn't have the political expenditures in recent cycles like it has before. So Republicans that you've been talking to this week, tell us, why are they still so afraid of the NRA?
I think you're right. I think the NRA, people give it way too much credit. It is a shell of its former self. It went through terrible management, terrible scandal, and as an organization just doesn't have the juice that it once had. What Republicans are responding to is they think they're responding to their base. They feel that the base doesn't like any effort by the federal government to start to tell any gun owner what they can and cannot do in terms of buying a weapon, and that they feel is where their party is. And Republican politicians, by the way, respond much more to their base than they do to these big institutions. They feel like they're not going to pay a political price. They feel like, I think a lot of them believe authentically that guns aren't the issue. They feel it's mental illness, or they feel that it's sort of the depression that flows and the madness that flows from social media. And so you take those two, and they constantly use that as that's the justification and explanation for why they oppose these laws. You know, when you talk to them, they also express this sort of like, toss your hands up hopelessness that, listen, there's already, 400 million weapons in the United States, and the more weapons that we have people. So will any of these gun laws actually curtail violence, which are flowing often from kids who are getting terribly depressed, maddened, often on social media, and then taking and doing these horrific acts? And so I don't think you're going to see the Republican Party move much on this topic. You might see them move in very, very small ways, like we were just discussing on Capitol Hill, to do small things around red flags or background checks. Remember, even red flag laws, we have places like Florida that are very conservative that have adopted their own version of it. And then I think we have 19 states now that have some version of a red flag or yellow flag law. So you could see grants, which I think Susan Collins from Maine has proposed, maybe incentives to get other states to follow through and then to do it effectively. And certainly each one of those little pieces is better than nothing. I think that's what you're hearing from Senator Murphy. He's saying, I'll take anything. I will compromise to take the smallest little piece just to show that we've done something, because every time there's a shooting, people say we'll do something and they do nothing. And it's very deflating for people who are involved in the process. Certainly it's awful for these families who go through this tragedy and watch the government nothing in response.
For now, that small bipartisan group is talking, just talking. We'll see if they do anything beyond that. Jim Vandehei of Axios. Jim, thanks so much. We always appreciate it. Coming up next, the NRA, as Jim mentioned, is going forward with its convention this weekend in Houston. Guns will not be allowed in the building, but it's not because of the recent shootings. Plus, Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy was asked why AR-15-style rifles should be legal. His answer may surprise you. We'll play that ahead. We're back in a moment.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
As the community of Uvalde, Texas, prepares for the funerals of 21 victims of Tuesday's shooting at Robb Elementary School, funerals still are being held for the 10 people gunned down at a grocery store in Buffalo, New York, less than 2 weeks ago. Joining us now, host of MSNBC's Politics Nation and president of the National Action Network, the Reverend Al Sharpton. He has attended and preached many of those funerals in Buffalo and will do so again today. Also with us, Marissa Renee Lee. She worked in the Obama administration and it's the author of the new book, Grief is Love, Living with Loss. Good morning to you both. It's great to have you. Rev, I want to begin with you as we look at the names and ages of these kids in Uvalde, Texas. I'm going back and looking at the names and ages of the 10 victims of that racist shooting in Buffalo. And you're going to preach the funeral of an 86-year-old this weekend. And coming up today, a 62-year-old who was at that top supermarket with her fiance, and he was in a different aisle and she was killed while shopping. What do you say to those families? What will you say to that congregation today? How do you bring any measure of peace?
It is very difficult because you're dealing with people that have to deal with things that does not make sense and that they did not expect. So they could not have any preparation. But what you have to challenge them to do is to really, in the memory of their loved one, try to raise this to have meaning. It is very difficult to have meaning in the middle of suffering, but that is what life presents to us. So what I'll say to the Talley family, my eulogy today, as well as tomorrow to the Whitfield family, is that we cannot kill their legacy because they were killed by a racist who took their life. We must live the life that they would want us to live and raise the ideas and the kinds of things we want society to become in their name. We must make good out of bad, as painful and difficult as that may be.
Marissa, your beautiful, heartbreaking book is called Grief is Love. It details your own loss, but also speaks more broadly to the loss that we all feel at times in our lives, sometimes as a country, as we're feeling right now. It feels so heavy. It feels difficult to get up and keep going. What do you say to people watching today who are really feeling the weight, especially in these last 2 weeks of these two shootings?
I want to tell people that it's normal. You know, we need to give ourselves permission to grieve in this moment. We didn't even have an opportunity to fully process the tragedy in Buffalo before this shooting happened this week in Texas. And let's not forget, we just crossed 1 million lives lost to COVID. You know, we are going through a lot as a country. And I think it's okay if you're feeling heavy. It's okay if you're feeling overwhelmed or sad or angry. Give yourself permission to have those feelings because you need to acknowledge all that's been lost. Like, we cannot heal from that which we do not acknowledge. So give yourself permission to grieve and let that grief, let that anger transition into hope that ultimately leads to action.
Marissa, Mike Barnicle has one for you. Mike.
Marissa, could you please speak to the grip that grief has on people, that it is, in many, many cases, never ending, and how you learn to live with that on a daily basis? I'm sure it recedes after a bit, but it is eternal.
Yeah, I define grief in Grief is Love as the repeated experience of learning to live in the midst of a significant loss. You know, I lost my mom over 14 years ago. I'm never going to forget that I had a mom, that I shared this amazing unconditional love relationship with this woman. And so, you know, every day, different weeks, different holidays, it is a recalibration process, you know, figuring out what you need in order to accommodate for your loss. It's not about getting over it. It's not about moving on. It's about treating yourself with love and compassion and grace as you learn what it is you need to be okay day to day without the person you love.
Stories of families from Sandy Hook who have reached out to other parents when there have been subsequent school shootings. And I'm wondering, you know, in your conversations with the families from Buffalo, just how much what happened in Uvalde then affected them again. I mean, they, you know, you get hit in a sense by a double hit. They are just reeling from what has happened in their own community, and they get the news that this has happened across the country to a group of children.
I have talked to a couple of the Buffalo families, and I'm sure I'll be talking to more today and tomorrow. And it only deepens their pain. And it also adds to being in this storm of violence, feeling even more lost because they're dealing with theirs and now they're seeing more. And it's like the winds are increasing rather than calming. And somehow I'm going to counsel them to reach out to each other. One of the things that I've seen is that when we saw the mothers of police brutality victims form their own group, Mothers of the Movement, they kind of help each other. Some of them lost children 20 years ago, but they help each other get through this because only they know each other's pain. You know, I might eulogize their funerals of their loved ones and lead the marches, but they know the pain that I don't know. I know how I felt when my mother died 10 years ago, but she didn't die in the kind of violence that their children died in. And I hope somehow that we could put these families together because that's what Mothers of the Movement did around the police brutality situation. And they're still together because there's a bonding. It's a club. Felonious Floyd, George Floyd's brother, says a club no one wants to join. But once you're in there, you understand each other and can help strengthen each other and get through this.
Such an important conversation about grief and compassion. But Rev, I want to switch to policy for a second. We don't know much about the motive of this shooting in Texas. We know the one in Buffalo fueled by a white supremacist ideology. I know in the wake of that shooting, you and other civil rights groups and leaders called for some sort of summit with the White House, some sort of buy-in. We need to talk about the scourge of white supremacy, also guns. So that would apply to Texas as well. Give us an update on that. I know you were frustrated at first. You didn't hear much back from President Biden's administration. Where do things stand?
We have had conversations with senior White House officials around this proposed summit. Both Jonathan Greenblatt of the Anti-Defamation League, Mark Morial, and I, and others have been involved in those conversations. They have not, the White House has not said yes, but they're looking very seriously at it. And when I was at the White House a couple of days ago for President Biden and Vice President Harris's ceremony around the police executive order he signed. I mentioned it to him briefly, and he is aware his senior staff is looking into it. So I think we may get it, but I can't say that we're sure. I think it is even more necessary. And when we're hearing what we're hearing now about what the law enforcement reaction was and what they did and maybe did not do in Texas, I think it's even more the reason we need to have a kind of summit to explore all of these things, because I think it's important. It is terrible, as Marissa said, to have the what we're looking at in Buffalo, what we're looking at in Texas. It's even worse when the grieving families have to look and say, could this have been avoided more? Could my child have been the one or two that would have been saved, that the police operated quicker, if that is what happened? That's why we need to sit down and look at these things seriously.
Those are the painful questions we're asking this morning. Reverend Al Sharpton shuttling between the White House and now back up to Buffalo, where he'll deliver eulogies for victims of the shooting in that city.
Rev, thanks for taking time with us. I'm going to preach from her book.
You know what? A lot of people need to read that book right now. No joke, Rev. We'll be watching Politics Nation this weekend on MSNBC. Marissa Renee Lee, thank you as well. The new book, as Rev just showed you, Grief is Love, Living with Loss. It is beautiful and it is essential right now. Marissa, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate it. Still ahead, authorities in Texas are trying to clear up the timeline for Tuesday's attack, and they've got a lot of clearing up to do. Some of the basic facts, though, remain unclear after the shooting. We'll lay out the latest account of what happened in Uvalde. We also will be joined by a council member from that city who was outside the school as the attack unfolded. Morning Joe's coming right back.
When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app.
New developments in the legal drama surrounding former President Donald Trump.
Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts.
Lots of news of all kinds going on right now.
And the latest updates on the 2024 election.
The rematch is on. It's Trump-Biden Part 2.
Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.